Lessons from old dead guys. Our lesson today is a guy named Adoniram Judson. I'm going to say, I'll mention a couple resources as we go along tonight that we will post links to on the website for you. But the main thing I would reference, if this intrigues you at all, you could, the best thing I know to dig into a little further is the biography called To the Golden Shore. To the Golden Shore. It's by Courtney Anderson, and it's a really good read. Very detailed. You'll get a very, very good picture of Adoniram Judson, much better than I can give you in an hour. But I read through that this week in preparation, just really enjoyed it. So it's called To the Golden Shore, and I think that's probably the one resource I'd mention as we get started, although there will be a couple more things that we'll throw up on the website for you as we get going. If you got a Bible, why don't you open up to Hebrews? Not chapter 5, we're not going back over that again, but Hebrews chapter 11, actually. I was struck by something reading through Hebrews as I was thinking on the life of Adoniram Judson. I want you to go to verse 32. You know, as a pastor in America, one of the things I've noticed so far in ministry is at least pastors, at least, have a huge fascination with huge churches, you know? Like, it seems like the equation is you are a great pastor if your church is huge, you know? I mean, if your church has several thousand people coming to it and you write that on your little blurb before you go speak in the conference, everybody wants to come out and hear your session. They're like our American heroes of the faith, our megachurch pastors, you know? I've never gone to, as of yet, a conference where they said, these guys are just ordinary. You know, they're fairly good pastors. They're faithful. They've won a few people to Christ. Their churches have grown. But I've gone to a lot of conferences where they go, this guy's church grew by 10,000 people the first year he was there. Come hear how he did it. And people go there thinking, man, that's a really good point. I think I can go there and figure out how to do that too. It struck me as I was reading Hebrews. Look at chapter 11, verse 32. It says, what more shall I say? He's already talked about all these heroes of the faith. For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms. These are like our American huge church pastors, right? The conquerors are huge. They conquer kingdoms. They enforce justice. They obtain promises. They stop the mouths of the lions. They quench the power of fire. They escape the edge of the sword. They were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead from resurrection. You see, those verses there, that's basically like every conference message I've gone to. What it is you get this guy who has this huge church. It's like this guy who, I've figured out the secret to stopping the mouths of lions. So here's the problem. A lot of you guys are going with an overhand grip where you're grabbing the mouths like this. If you cross your hands and hold the mouth, that's how you stop it. Not like maybe God just did this, you know? And maybe that's just something that he does. No, I've got it. You cross hand grip the mouth of a lion to stop the mouth. Okay. Now I got the technique down. I'll go back. I'll replicate that and get my hands cut off because I'm not him. Everybody wants to be that guy who stops the mouth of a lion, right? That's a hero of the faith, except we keep reading. Verse 35, some of them were what? Tortured. Refusing to accept release that they might rise again to a better life. Others were mocked and flogged and even suffered chains and imprisonment. Some of them were stoned. They were sawn in two. I think this is a reference to Jeremiah. That's the Jewish tradition says that's how his life ended. He was ripped in two. You realize Jeremiah, right? Anybody want to be a Jeremiah in your ministry? God says, I have had my hand on you from birth, Jeremiah. You're going to be my mouthpiece. You're going to speak, and no one will ever listen to you. That's the call to ministry for Jeremiah. Go and preach. He makes one convert his entire ministry. Everyone hates him. He gets so discouraged by the ministry, at one point he says, I will not speak the word of God anymore, and resolves never to preach again. But then there he says, but the word of God was in my bones like a fire. I couldn't hold it back. Anybody want to be a Jeremiah? Go preach faithfully your whole life. Get ripped into one convert. And he's a hero of the faith. That's my point. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. See, I love that we get to talk about Adoniram Judson this week, because last week we talked about George Whitefield, who was a meteor of success in Christianity. Everywhere the man went, thousands showed up and people were just converted. Just, it's just unbelievable the work that George Whitefield did. Today, we're going to study the life of Adoniram Judson, who I think rightly is a hero of the faith. And this man, in his first 12 years on the mission field, had 18 converts to show for it. His ministry was marked all the way through by death and suffering. Unbelievable suffering. 18 converts in 12 years never gets you invited in America to speak at a pastor's conference. At least not one that I've been at. That gets you fired. And I want to look at this man, because what he suffered for the cause of Christ and for the spread of the gospel is remarkable. And what God achieved as a fruit through his suffering is unreal. It is amazing what God has done now through this man. But I'll tell you, I don't think Judson, in the midst of it, constantly felt like a world conqueror. I think he felt crushed, like he was being ripped in two internally. Now, I always try to give lessons throughout the people's lives. I want to save up my lesson for the end. Okay, so that means I'm going to tell his whole life story in one swath. I'm breaking my rule. And then I'm going to try to give you the lesson. Okay? Everybody all right with that? Because you have no choice anyways. I'm doing it whether you like it or not. So, glad that you're in. Let's go through his life together. Adoniram Judson, Jr., was born August the 9th of 1788. He died April the 12th of 1850. He lived 61 years. He was a missionary who served in Burma for nearly 40 years of his life. Burma is our present-day country, Myanmar. It's in Southeast Asia. He was the first Protestant missionary sent from North America to preach the gospel in Southeast Asia. Okay, he was part of a group of churches known as the Congregationalists. He was the first foreign missionary ever sent out by the Congregationalist denomination. He established churches in Burma. He was born in 1788. He was the son of a congregational minister, Adoniram Judson the Senior. His wife, his mother, was named Abigail. He had two sisters, Abby and El Nathan, which in Spanish means the Nathan. Now, I don't know. I don't think that's a Spanish name. But El Nathan seems just so awkward, so I'll just say the Nathan throughout tonight. He was a very, very smart kid, okay? His dad one time went away on a week-long trip. Adoniram was age 3, and in the week his father was away, his mother taught him to read. No, literally read. Like, he sat down when his dad came home and read the entire page of the Bible that was in front of him. He's 3. Brilliant kid. By the time he shows up at college, he goes to college at age 16. He's enrolled in what is now Brown University. And he is admitted as a sophomore, not a freshman, because he had already mastered all the material that would have been given a freshman. There's no reason to teach him something he was good at. Anyways, he graduates in 3 years as the valedictorian of his class at the age of 19. He's brilliant linguistically. He knows multiple languages very, very well. While he's at college, though, he becomes friends with a man. I want you to remember this guy's name, Jacob Eames. Okay, just so we know we're well with one another. Can you just say it? Jacob Eames. Okay, say it with me. Jacob Eames. Keep that name. Keep that name because that's going to matter. I'm going to come back to that. Jacob Eames was a devout deist, a skeptic, and a denier of the Christian faith. Eames and Judson formed a deep friendship, and Eames led Judson to abandon his childhood faith and the religious instruction of his parents. He denied the truth of Christianity. I need to click along here. Now, in 1808, on his 20th birthday, August the 9th, he had the fun birthday present, which he unwrapped for his parents, of professing he no longer believed the Christian faith and rejecting everything. His dad had given him a horse for his birthday, which Adoniram promptly mounted 6 days later and rode away from his family home. Great kid. He has a habit, by the way. He's impetuous, okay? He decides to do something, and 5 days later, he does it all through his life. So he mounts the horse 6 days after he tells his parents he's done with Christianity. He rides to New York City. He's going to start a life in the theater. He's going to write plays. He arrives in New York City and figures out no one makes any money writing plays in New York City, especially not if you're an unproven boy from New England. So, after a little bit of dabbling in that, he decides, I have no money, I have nothing left, I need to go home. He hops back on the horse that his dad gave him, begins his trek from home, but he needs to stay overnight. He pulls into a small village inn, and I want to jump into the record that Courtney Anderson records in his biography, To the Golden Shore. As night drew on, he found himself passing through a small village. Finding the local inn, he stabled his horse and he asked the innkeeper for a room. The house was nearly full. But the landlord said he had one room next to a young man who was critically ill, perhaps even dying. He might be disturbed in his sleep by the cries of death, but no, Adoniram said. He was still wrapped in his own thought. He would not let a few noises of a dying man next door deny him his night's rest. After getting something to eat, the landlord lighted Adoniram to his room and left him. Without further ado, Adoniram got into bed and he waited for sleep to come. But though the night was still, he could not sleep, for in the next room beyond the partition, he could hear sounds, not very loud, but footsteps coming and going, boards creaking, low voices, groaning, gasping. These didn't disturb him unduly. What disturbed him was the thought that the man in the next room might not be prepared for death. Was he himself prepared to die? Well, when he woke in the morning, he dressed quickly and ran downstairs. He was looking for the innkeeper. It was past time to have breakfast, pay his reckoning, saddle his horse, and be on his way. He found the host. He asked for the bill, and perhaps noticing the somber face of the man, casually asked the young man whether the young man in the next room was any better. "He's dead," was the answer. Dead? Adoniram was taken aback. There was a heavy finality in the word. For an instant, some of his fear of the night made itself felt once more. He stammered out a few conventional phrases common to humanity when death takes someone nearby, and then asked the inevitable question, "Do you know who he was?" "Oh yes, he was a young man from the college in Providence by the name of Eames, Jacob Eames." Remember that name I had you memorize? At a random inn that he stops by for a night, he happens upon a room next to a dying man who happens to be the man who convinced him to give up his Christian faith. It's said that he was so shaken that he sat in silence for 2 hours, unmoving, and then got on his horse and began the long ride home with one word that echoed through his mind the entire way: lost. Eames was lost, and he was lost. He knew it. He arrived home convinced the God of the Bible was real and that he was lost and headed to hell. But he wasn't converted yet. He simply knew he was lost. So he enrolled, wanting to pursue the things of God, he enrolls in Andover Theological Seminary, October the 12th of 1808. He's still not converted. He's given a special allowance by the seminary to come in as an unbeliever. He is engrossed in his studies. He gives himself to prayer. And this is his own testimony. Over the months, his doubts began to leave little by little. He underwent no sudden conversion. He felt no blinding flash of insight. He was able to note that he began to entertain a hope of having received the regenerating influences of the Holy Spirit. And on the second day of December, 1808, a day that he would mark down and never forget, he made a solemn dedication of himself to the Lord and would never again doubt his fate. He was a Christian in life and in death. And he would now set about finding a way to serve his master in heaven. That's 1808. So he is 20 years old. The next year, he reads a book on a foreign country, Burma. It paints this wonderful picture of this foreign land just ripe for the harvest of missionaries. And he thinks, I could go there. I could do that work. He begins to contemplate whether the best way to use his life for God would be to give himself to foreign missions. Now, just understand, that's a very radical thought. It's not something you'd arrive at very easily, considering no one had ever been sent out in America to do foreign missions. Okay, just think of that. You're going to up to people to raise money. Hi, my name's Adoniram. I'd like to be a missionary. What do you mean? Like you're going to go talk to the Indians over there? No. I want to be a missionary. Like I want to leave here to go there where they don't know Jesus and I want to talk to them about that. People don't even know the concept. Well, he does, though, the next year, 1810, happen upon a group of people that are called the Brethren. It's a solemn group of six men who have themselves also arrived at the conclusion that God has called them to leave America to go to a foreign country and serve in missions. They resolve together to petition the Board of Congregational Churches in America to see if they can be granted a call to go as missionaries. They stand before the assembly in 1810. They present a petition asking to receive financial support as foreign missionaries. And God's in it. And their proposal is accepted. This is 1810. Now, in order to raise money, though, there's no funds in the coffers, so to speak, to send foreign missionaries out. They've never done this undertaking before, and the churches are fairly poor in America. So they say, what we need you to do is help us raise some money, so please would you be willing to take a voyage, Adoniram, to London. Well, he is willing to take that voyage to London, and so in 1811, he leaves for London. January of 1811. The journey should be fairly uncomplicated, but the boat he's on is taken hostage by a French privateer who captures the ship and takes everyone prisoner. Good start to the whole missionary career. It's a sign of things to come. It really is. In all, it takes him 6 months to do what should have taken him 2. He does eventually get to London, at which point he's told, this is a very good idea, you being missionaries, but I don't know that we want to give our money to you. We have no idea who you are. Why are you leaving from America to come to us to ask money when you guys just established a mission agency in America? Why don't you just go raise some money? Good idea. He heads back to America. Okay, having little financial assistance. Now, here's the thing. Before he left for London, however, he has met a girl. He actually met her the same day he gave the proposal to the Congregationalists to do a foreign mission. He meets a girl named Nancy Hasseltine, Anne Hasseltine. Her father is a Congregationalist minister, and they begin a whirlwind love affair. And he asks her hand in marriage. Now, I just want to read you. These are love letters, folks. This is the letter he writes to her dad to ask her hand in marriage. He receives this while Adoniram is on his voyage over to London. I have now to ask whether you consent to part with your daughter early next spring to see her never again in this world. whether you can consent to her departure to a heathen land and her subjection to the hardships and sufferings of a missionary life, whether you can consent to her exposure to the danger of the ocean, to the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want and distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and even a violent death, can you consent to all of this? This is the letter asking her dad. Young men, this is not the way you ask. But why does he do it? Can you consent to all this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you? Her dad, he's a pastor. He has to say yes to that, right? He does. Here's the love letter he writes to Nancy. What a love letter. May this be the year in which you will change your name, in which you will take a final leave of your relatives and your native land, in which you will cross the wide ocean and dwell on the other side of the world among a heathen people. What a great change this year will effect in our lives. How very different our situation and our employment. If our lives are preserved and our attempt prospered, we shall next year's day be in India and perhaps with wish each other a happy new year in the dialect of the Hindu or the Burman. We shall no more see our friends around us or enjoy the conveniences of civil life or go to the house of God with those that keep the holy day, but swarthy countenances shall everywhere meet our eye. The jargon of an unknown tongue will assail our ears. We shall witness the assembling of heathen to worship their idol gods. We shall be weary of the world and wish for wings of doves that we may fly away and be at rest. We shall probably experience seasons where we will be exceedingly sorrowful even unto death. We will see many dreary, disconsolate hours and feel a sinking of spirits, anguish of mind, of which we can form little conception now. How true that would be. Oh, we shall wish to lie down and die, and he would. And that time may soon come. One of us may be unable to sustain the heat of the climate and the change of habits. The other may say with literal truth over the grave, by foreign hands thy dying eyes were closed. By foreign hands, thy decent limbs composed. By foreign hands, thy humble grave adorned. But whether we shall be honored or mourned by strangers, God only knows. At least for either of us, at our death, there will be one mourner. In view of such circumstances, let us pray with earnestness for an overcoming faith. That's a love letter. This guy's pretty hardcore. I mean, he is committed to the death. So, September the 9th, 1811, Judson is appointed by the Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions as a missionary to the East, along with four of his friends from the Brethren Society of Andover Seminary. 1812 leads to his marriage to Anne. After being commissioned by the Congregational Church, he is married to Anne Hasseltine on February the 5th, 1812. He's ordained the next day, and on February the 19th, compute that, that's 14 days later, he sets sail with his brand new bride of 2 weeks aboard a ship known as the Caravan with Luther Rice, Samuel and Harriet Newell, and his wife, Nancy Judson. He's 24 years old. Okay, that's five of them, right? Five of them. They voyage to India. It takes 114 days journey by sea. That's about how long it takes. So you who are good at math, figure out how long that is. 4 months. While aboard the ship in India, ship en route to India, they spend their time talking, they dance for exercise. You have to do something to get your sea legs, and so dancing apparently is a good idea. I had no idea. And Adoniram, to spend his time, undertakes a fresh translation of the Greek New Testament for enjoyment. I'm telling you, he's a smart kid. In his study of the Greek New Testament aboard the boat, though, he comes across something that seems peculiar to him in the dealing with the Greek word baptizo, our word for baptism. He studies every instance of the word usage in the New Testament, and he finds no indication that baptism was ever done by sprinkling or that baptism was ever administered to anyone who had not made a public profession of faith. Now, here's the significance of this. He's a Congregationalist, which means he was sprinkled as an infant. Okay? Now, he was sent out by the Congregationalists, but by the time they arrive in India, both Adoniram and Nancy have become convinced of the merits of believers' baptism by immersion. They are Baptists. They leave Congregationalists. They arrive Baptists, and they are baptized by immersion on September the 6th, 1812, by an associate of William Carey in India. Now, that's something of a mess, because now all your fundraising base is screwed up. But Adoniram never thought about anything like that. He just did what he thought God told him to do, and he left the rest to others to figure out. And so he writes some letters back home and says, by the way, I'm a Baptist. Could you forward these to the Baptist churches? It ends up being that they establish a foreign mission board as well, ultimately to end up supporting Adoniram Judson. So he is the impetus behind the first Baptist foreign mission board and the first Congregationalist foreign mission board. Pretty amazing. Upon arriving, though, at Calcutta, they are met with a bracing response. First, the local missionaries. William Carey himself, the famous British missionary, is in Calcutta, India. And Adoniram reveals to him his plan to go to this country of Burma that he's read about. William Carey says, that's a terrible idea. They will kill you. See, the book that Judson had read in college about Burma happened to be very inaccurate. The country of Burma was not beautiful and was not receptive to Westerners. They hated Westerners, and they tended to kill all the missionaries who came. And so William Carey says, you need to throw the idea of going to Burma out and never think about it again. This is William Carey, right? Father of modern missions. When you hear that from him, you ought to just pack your bags up and stay in India. Well, that's not a possibility either, by the way. The British East India Company has taken somewhat of a dislike to foreigners coming in and preaching the gospel to the heathen because it threatens and jeopardizes their trade routes. So they have the local authorities now hounding the Judsons and their missionary companions and basically coming to the point of forcibly kicking them out of the country. They are ordered by the authorities to immediately return to America. Well, where can they go? Well, to delay their immediate return to America, what they do is they secure passage to go from India to the Isle of France, which is near Madagascar. The Newells will go first because in this time, 19-year-old Harriet Newell has become pregnant. She's now 6.5 months along in her pregnancy. The voyage will take about a month, so they secure passage for her to go from India to the Isle of France. A few months later, the Judsons follow suit. And on January 17th, 1813, they look forward to a reunion with their friends, the Newells, at the Isle of France. But there would be no happy reunion. On the boat to the Isle of France, there was a delay. And instead of being at sea a month, they were at sea 3 months. And Harriet gave birth to a baby girl aboard the ship with no one to assist her but her husband. Within 5 days, a severe storm occurred. The girl and Harriet were both drenched, and the baby caught pneumonia and died 5 days later in her mother's arms. By the time they hit land, Harriet Newell, 19-year-old missionary, was so desperately sick that within weeks of arriving, she too was dead. She was 19 years old. They arrive at the Isle of France for a reunion, and their companion and their baby have died. They're a year into their journey now. Okay, think of it. They left in February. It's now January. They're unable to go to Burma and told by William Carey never to go. They're mourning the death of their friend Harriet. They are hounded by the local authorities to return to America. Word now comes down that they are about to be arrested and forcibly taken to England. So Adoniram seeks escape, and there's one vessel that will take them, a vessel named the Georgina, and it is headed to the destination of Burma. So they get on board. Nancy Judson, by this time, is pregnant, very pregnant, but they have no choice. They must get on board or they will be arrested. They've been at sea only a few days. When Nancy goes into her labor, Like her friend Harriet, there is no one to help her but her husband Adoniram. The baby is born dead. They land a few days later in Burma, July 13th of 1813. Nancy is desperately ill, but she recovers. They find a place to stay, and they begin studying the language of Burmese. Now, you need to keep in mind, there's no language school for these people when they arrive on a foreign field. There's no one who speaks English around them. No one. Which means, you ever travel to a foreign country? You know that headache that comes in after a few days? You know, where you're just so sick of hearing everyone talk something, you have no idea what they're saying. They would go through that for 3 years before the next English-speaking missionary would arrive. Which means for 3 years, apart from conversation with one another, they never heard English. Adoniram threw himself into language study. He found a tutor and began to study the Burmese language 12 hours a day. At first, they had no idea how to teach. So Adoniram would point at an object, and he would say the word in English, and he would say the word in Burmese. They would begin to piece together the language. Imagine learning a language like that. Wow. Well, they give themselves to the work. So from 1814 to 1818, they study the language as fervently as they can. In this time, September 11th, 1815, their son Roger is born. He's a very good baby. He's very happy. His parents love him dearly. He's a fantastic joy. And by May of the next year, at 6 months old, he develops a terrible fever and he dies. The death breaks their hearts, but it does something very, very important. The local Burmese see the suffering of these Americans and they begin to feel sympathy. In fact, the governor's wife takes them out on a number of elephant ride excursions. It's like I guess that's what they do for fun in Burma. They ride elephants. And so she begins to take them with them. And this is very important because her husband's a fairly high-ranking official in the government, and she forms a lifelong friendship with Nancy Judson. Now, Nancy Judson, the wife, is actually much better in the language than her brilliant husband. He becomes a grammar master who can write it, but she can speak it far more quickly than Adoniram can, which seems to be true of many missionaries. For some reason, the wives and the kids get it, and the husbands are terrible at it, but they're supposed to be preaching. At least that's what Lucas and Teresa are like. They're down in Brazil, and Lucas will tell you all the time, Teresa just runs circles around him with Portuguese, and he's working on this, and Teresa knows it all. That's all right. It's good for Lucas. He needs to be humbled. I love him. But in this time, here's the significance. Adoniram does finish a translation of a gospel tract that for the first time in the history of the world puts the gospel of Jesus Christ into the language of the Burmese people. And he has it printed. He begins to distribute it to people. Now by 1819, he has grown in his ability with the language enough so that he thinks he could speak it publicly with people and explain Christianity. So he builds something called a zayat. It's like a discussion house. It's a traditional Burmese thing. The Buddhist priests would always do it, and they would have these open things, and people who are seekers, he would stand on the porch and he would yell, "Ho, all of you who seek wisdom." You know, and people who are seeking wisdom, apparently they sought it. I don't know, but they would walk in and they would sit down. And they would listen. 15 people come to the first meeting that he holds. That's April of 1819. Now just contemplate that. April 1819. They left in 1812. So they've been on the field for 7 years, and now they hold their first meeting, okay? Within 2 months, the first Burmese convert, Mayung Nau, a 35-year-old timber worker from the hill tribes, was baptized. 7 years in, one convert. Why? Well, it's very, very dangerous. The people who would convert to Christianity were threatened regularly with death. if they would convert. And so in 1820, Judson goes and actually petitions the emperor for freedom of religion in Burma. The emperor reads a few lines of his gospel tract, crumples it to the ground, and walks away. Request denied. The progress of Christianity will be slow, and will risk endangerment and death to preach the gospel. From 1821 to 1823, he continues on in this labor, beginning to lay the foundations for a full translation of the New Testament. In that period of time, 3 years of slowly evangelizing, by 1823, 10 years after their arrival, the membership of their little church had grown to 18, and he had completed a rough translation of the New Testament in Burmese. And in 1824, as 1824 began, he was preparing the New Testament to go into print. So he's getting ready to print the Bible when war breaks out. It's the first Anglo-Burmese war. Burma wants more territory. England wants more money through trade. The two are competing interests, and so they go to war. And everyone who's white in the country of Burma is suspected of being a spy. English or American. And on June 8, 1824, Adoniram Judson is arrested as a British spy. Officers led by an official executioner burst into his home. They throw Judson on the ground in front of his wife. They bind him with torture tongs. They drag him off to an infamous vermin-ridden death prison in Ava. At night, his feet and arms would have been fettered together with iron clasps, and there was a bamboo pole that would be stretched across the room, and they would feed the pole through so that they would hang all night long upside down with the back of their head and their shoulders touching the ground through the night so they could not escape while the guards slept. They slept like that for months. Within a couple weeks of his imprisonment, Adoniram Judson also receives the news that his wife Nancy is pregnant. His pregnant wife would daily walk 2 to 4 miles round trip from her home every day for 17 months, petitioning the government for the release of her husband. And you don't get food in Burmese prisons unless somebody brings it to you. So she would daily bring rice and food to sustain the prisoners. She was his lifeline. Eventually, her bribery of officials gained Adoniram the incredible privilege of not having to be bound with the iron and hung upside down at night so he could live on his own. Sleep, you know, on the ground, which is a big upgrade. Almost a year later, after entering the death prison at the capital of Ava, they are sent suddenly to a more distant village prison. They're forced to walk there. They walk miles. You got to understand, they're so malnourished, they can barely move. They walk miles and miles dressed in rags, crippled from torture. And when they get there, their feet are bleeding and raw, and the mosquitoes from the rice paddies come out in swarms at night and just eat them alive. By now, he has a daughter who has been born, Maria. And Anne has worked so hard to sustain his life that she is barely alive. She was his basic source of food, remember? But now she's also the basic source of food through her milk for her daughter. And she is so ill, her milk has dried up, and she cannot feed her baby girl. And so in an act of pity, the chief jailer agrees to let Judson leave the prison for 2 hours every night to take his malnourished baby and beg the village women to nurse her so she doesn't die. He does that for 7 months. On November the 4th of 1825, Adoniram Judson is suddenly released the government needed him to translate in their negotiations with the British. 17 months in prison and on the brink of death, with his wife sacrificing herself daily to keep him alive. But Anne's heart and her health are broken. Within 11 months of his release, Nancy Judson dies, October the 24th of 1826. And 6 months later, her daughter dies as well, April the 24th of 1827. The suffering nearly drives him mad. Self-doubt overtakes him. He begins to wonder if his lust for fame was why he became a missionary, which is a very sick sort of thinking. He begins to read the Catholic mystics, Madame Guyon, Fenelon, Thomas a Kempis. He goes into a life of solitary asceticism. He engages in forms of self-mortification to kill the remaining flesh within him. He drops his work on the New Testament and the Old Testament. He drops his love of life. More and more, he withdraws from people. He withdraws from anything that might conceivably support his pride or promote his pleasure. He even writes in his journals, and this time, God is to me the great unknown. I believe in him, but I cannot find him. Over the period of the next 2 to 3 years, he slowly climbs out of deadly depression. Ironically, it's the news of another death that serves to wake him from his depression. His brother, Elnathan, however you pronounce that thing, has died. He was his younger brother. But here's why this helps to wake him. When Adoniram left the United States, his brother was a denier of Christianity. And in the letter informing him of his death, he's told that in the last year of his life, his brother had given his life to Christ. And it begins to see maybe just a glimmer of hope in his suffering. And he's climbing out of the darkness. And then something remarkable happens. In 1828, he was joined on the mission field by colleagues, Sarah and George Boardman. They were British missionaries to Burma. They began ministering to a native tribe that was called the Karen. Now, astonishingly, these Burmese natives were prepared for the gospel. Just listen to this. Contained in the ancient oracle traditions of the Karen was the belief in an unchangeable, eternal, all-powerful God, the creator of heaven, earth, of man, and of woman, who created woman from a rib taken from the side of man. They believed in humanity's temptation by a devil, its fall into sin, and the belief that someday a Messiah, a rescuer, would come. They lived in expectation of a prophecy that one day white foreigners would bring with them a sacred book that would tell the truth of the rescuer. And they were in the middle of a jungle in Burma, unknown to Adoniram Judson until 1828. Just think about that. Years. The Boardmans take with them the completed translation of the Bible into Burma done by Adoniram Judson in 1834. He had worked on it for 24 years. It was printed, it was published in 1835. It was so good, it is still the Bible in use in Myanmar today. It's the Bible they use. George Boardman himself died attempting to reach the Karen. He caught a malarial fever and passed away. But in 1834, April of 1834, Adoniram Judson marries the widow of George Boardman, Sarah Hall Boardman. They would have 8 children together, 3 of whom died, 5 of whom survived to adulthood, and they were an ideal missionary pairing. Their ministry to the Burmese was now spreading the gospel at a rapid speed because these Karen that they would go to knew of a legend of a white man who would bring them the truth. And they're converting in mass to Christianity. So 12 years, 18 converts, and now he'll walk into a village and tell the stories of Christ, and 18 converts will be made on the spot. These are wonderful years of ministry for him. 13 years with his wife. However, late 1844, Sarah's health begins to deteriorate rapidly. By September the 1st of 1845, her only hope of surviving was to return to America for medical treatment. Adoniram goes with her, and Sarah dies en route to America September the 1st of 1845. She's buried at sea. Judson continues home, where upon arriving in America, he is greeted as a celebrity and touring the country. His first wife had a period of sickness where she had to return to America, and Nancy wrote an account of what was going on in Burma and the suffering that they had gone through for Christ, which sold like wildfire and promoted the spread of missionary endeavors unlike anything that had ever happened in the history of America. He toured the Eastern Seaboard, raising money for missions. By this point, his voice was so shot from perpetual illness that he could barely speak above a whisper. And so his public addresses, actually, he's the opposite of George Whitefield. George Whitefield could be heard for miles, and Judson could barely be heard in personal conversation. So he had an assistant who would travel with him who would speak his words again for him because he couldn't talk loud enough. 1846, while in America, June the 2nd of 1846, Judson is married for a third time to Miss Emily Chubbuck. She's a writer, a well-known writer, and actually she is commissioned to write the biographical memoirs of his second wife, Sarah Hall Boardman, which goes on to sell like wildfire again, promoting the cause of missions. They had a daughter who was born to them in 1847. The 3 years, these years they were together were a great joy for Adoniram. His labors focus now on evangelizing and producing a full Burmese dictionary so that future missionaries could continue to translate works into Burmese. By 1850, Judson has developed a very serious lung disease, and doctors prescribe a sea voyage as the cure. This would be of no avail. He was in miserable pain. He would be roused from time to time with terrible pain that would end in vomiting. His one friend on the boat with him at sea commented, "How few there are who die so hard." And on April 12th, 1850, he took his last breath on this side. Age 61, aboard a ship in the Bay of Bengal, he was buried at sea. 10 days later, April 22nd of 1850, Emily gave birth to their second child who died at birth. Emily, 4 months later, when the ship returned, learned that her husband had died while he was out at sea. She returned to New England that next January, and 3 years later died of tuberculosis, which was an effect of her missionary endeavors. Here's his legacy. I'll just say this. That is unbelievable suffering, isn't it? Oh, how this man suffered. I can't even tell you the half of it. Anguish. For what? Was that worth it? Here's what he left. The Bible in Burmese, still used today. A dictionary used for years and years. He had started 100 churches. When he went there initially, he said, "If God would give me a translation of the Bible and 100 converts, my life's work would have been great." By the end of his time in Burma, he left not 100 converts, but 100 churches. 8,000 believers reported at the time of his death. A host of missionaries drawn to the foreign field by the stories they read of the great Adoniram Judson. And today, there are 3,700 Baptist congregations in the small country of Myanmar. That is second in number of congregations only to the United States and India in the world. Those 37 congregations number 617,781 members, give or take. Twelve converts in 18 years. You ever heard of like compound interest? This is compound interest of souls. Now I saved the lesson till now. Here's the lesson. God's design is for the global spread of the gospel. Jesus gave us a final commission. Matthew chapter 28, 18 to 20. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all I've commanded you. And behold, I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. And one of the scenes in the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 5, verse 9, pictures a scene with a throng of people around the throne of Christ. And they're singing, "Worthy are you to take the scroll, to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from," and here's the key, "every tribe and language and people and nation." Every tribe and language and people and nation, which was the unshakable confidence of Adoniram Judson. When he landed in Burma, he looked at a heathen land and he said, "God has people here." He promised it. He believed God had people in Burma, so he went. If we believe God has people in Togo, let's go. John Piper writes this, "Patrick Johnstone says in Operation World that only in the 1990s did we get a reasonably complete listing of all the world's people groups. For the first time, we can see clearly what is left to be done in foreign missions. There are 12,000 ethno-linguistic peoples in the world. Of about 3,500 of these, on average, have less than 1% Christian population in their country. That is to say, there is a group of people in the world with about 2 billion persons resident in those countries where the entire population of Christianity combined numbers less than 20 million. Of these, the majority of them are located in this region of the globe that we call the 1040 window. Round the equator." I'm not saying we don't need missionaries everywhere. We need missionaries in Brazil and in North America and all over the place to preach the gospel. We do. But I'm saying we need some people with an Adoniram Judson sort of heart who say, "I want to go where Christ has never been heard. I want to talk to people who've never even heard Jesus." Can you imagine it? That you could go somewhere and speak the name of Jesus to someone who's never heard that word, Jesus. They've never heard. They live here. The majority of them live there. And here's the reality. The gospel will only penetrate these areas if God's people are willing to suffer and die to take it there. That's the reality, guys. Those countries, the majority of them, are closed. You cannot just walk in and say, "I want to preach the gospel," on a street corner. It is illegal. You'll be taken prisoner in a lot of them. You'll be killed in a lot of them. This is the design of God. He said it, John 12:24, "Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone, but if it dies, it will bear much fruit." We are called to endure suffering because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example. so that we might follow in his steps. I want to introduce you to somebody as we close. That's my sister. She looks a lot like me, so you shouldn't be confused about that. That's Megan. Megan is 18 months younger than me. She's 26 years old. She's brilliant. Not smart. Brilliant. She graduated from Cedarville with a double major 4.0. She's a top nursing student in her class. She had her pick of jobs in the United States, and she left it all. I'm hugging her there. That was about 11 months ago, 10, 11 months ago, right before she left to go as a medical missionary to Bangladesh, the country that touches Burma. The city she lives in, Chittagong, was frequented by Adoniram Judson. She's a medical worker, so she can get in the country, right? You couldn't just walk up and say, I want to go evangelize. But she can go. Avery was born shortly after Megan left. She's never held her niece. Owen kind of remembers her. We talk about Aunt Megan a lot. We pray for her constantly. We talk on Skype when she's got a powerful internet connection, which is fairly rare because Bangladesh is like the poorest of the poor. Togo and Bangladesh kind of fight with Haiti for the worst place on earth. Sometime in the future, I'll buy a plane ticket and fly over there to see her on the worst vacation of my life. And sometime in the future, she'll come back here to the States to raise support so she can continue to leave there. Many of her college classmates have gone on to more lucrative careers. They've got nicer homes. They have better cars. They have better internet. They get to play with their nephews and their nieces. But Megan, somewhere along the line, looked at the world who did not know the Christ she knew. And she said, it's not a sacrifice to leave. I'm emotional because I love her, right? Not because I regret her going. Not for an instant. It's worth it. It is worth every sacrifice. It was worth every sacrifice Adoniram Judson made for the gospel to go to Burma. It is worth it to give our lives for this. It's worth it for me if she never comes back. We have heaven. We have heaven. And if we're going to make a dent in the 1040 window in my lifetime, we need thousands of Megans. We need thousands to go. To say, I don't need a big house or a nice job or a great life here when there are people who've never heard the name of Jesus. So get involved. Eat out less to give more to missions. Seriously. Just don't go to dinner together and give the money to somebody. Get involved yourself. Get the book, Operation World, which lists the countries of this globe where they do not have the gospel, and begin to pray with them. Get a globe and spin it around with your kids and let your finger land somewhere and pray for the people who've never heard of Jesus. I want Owen to grow up with a vision for something more than a great car. I want him to know people that know Christ. And some of us, like my sister, need to go. That's the reality. We will not make a dent unless some go. Unless some who are brilliant, like Adoniram Judson, will give it all up for the sake of people where you might make 12 converts in 18 years for the glory of God. So let's go. Let's get involved whatever way God calls us, whatever way we can. Some of us are to stay here. I'm not trying to guilt trip us into foreign missions. I'm saying the reality is there are people who've never heard, and if we don't take the message, they never will.